Hello, and welcome to The Slow Revolution, the podcast where we explore the pros and cons of slowing down in a fast and impatient world. I'm Carl Honoré, your host, and my guest this week is Rohan Gunatilaka. How would I sum up Rohan? In two words, probably. Mindfulness maven. The world is going through a mindfulness or meditation boom at the moment. We all know that. And there are loads of experts out there, but Rohan stands out from the crowd. Wired magazine put him on its smart list of 50 people who will change the world. Why? Because Rohan is at the cutting edge of making mindfulness relevant and real in a busy digital world. His company, Mindfulness Everywhere, makes apps and products that help us be more mindful. Maybe you've heard of their blockbuster meditation app, Buddhify. Rohan recently published a book called This Is Happening. And when I heard he was passing through London, I invited him to my house for a chat. And this is what happened next. Okay, so here I am in my own front room in London, family portraits on the walls, books on the shelves, the curtains drawn to create a womb-like studio atmosphere. And I'm sitting with Rohan. Rohan, thank you for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carl. It's a pleasure to be in your front room. Not only to be doing the podcast, but we're doing it in your house.
It's a first, actually. It's a first. Well, we're here to talk about your wonderful book, This Is Happening. We'll dig into that a little more deeply in a moment, but I wanted to start off by asking you about your own experience of meditation and a kind of aha moment that you describe in the book a little bit. You've been doing meditation, you're now in your mid-30s, you started university, you were 22, I think, at the time, so sure. We're talking about 12 or 13 years under your belt of mindfulness practice and meditation. But there was a moment, and quite a remarkably dramatic moment, when you realized that meditation was a very powerful tool. And I wonder if you could walk us through that story.
Sure. On the day before my wedding, so this was about 3 years ago, we'd arranged a really lovely wedding weekend in Dorset, where my wife is from. And on the full ceremony and so on was on the Sunday, and on the Saturday was more of a social, we're going to play some cricket, have a little barbecue, that kind of thing, so everyone gets to meet each other. So on the Saturday morning, everyone was running around, all the family were running around just trying to get things organized. And I had to go back to my in-laws' house to do some chores, pick up some keys. And as I closed the boot of my car, I noticed actually the car started very slowly creeping forward down what was an inclined drive. And I did the thing that you should never do, basically, which was thinking that I could somehow stop it. I went all the way around to the badge of the car, like right on the VW, on the VW badge. And like Newtonian physics did its thing, the car picked up speed and momentum happened. And all in a flash, it all happened very quickly. I was suddenly realized the next thing I knew, I was pinned, the car just sort of picked up and then pinned me against, dropped down a ledge actually and pinned me against the side of the house. And so suddenly here I was the day before my wedding, trapped by what, like over tons worth of Volkswagen against a brick wall. I guess the first thing I did was sort of wiggle my toes to see, like, because the impact was actually quite significant because I was pushed back against the wall and then the car closed in on me. And so to wiggle my toes, had I broken any bones? I thought I hadn't broken any bones, I wasn't 100% sure. And then the next thought was, I'm such an idiot. There's no one in the house. Everyone was around the village doing different bits of preparation work. And so
it sounded to me when I was reading it like a scene out of the Hangover movies.
It was absolutely. It was like, if it wasn't so awful at the time, yeah. It would be funny, I guess. And I guess the thing that happened then was that it took actually 45 minutes or an hour until emergency vehicles were able to release me and pull the car away. And over that time, the pressure of the car was getting more and more intense on my. So whilst I may have not broken a bone, in the end I hadn't broken any bones, but the pressure on my thighs and my legs was becoming really, really quite difficult. And the increased risk, when you're in a situation like the risk is around septic shock and like losing blood circulation and these sort of terrible things. So in that moment, that was one of the real moments when I was able to draw on the skills that I basically developed over the last previous sort of 10, 12 years of being able to stay calm in this really high-pressure situation. Because the first place your mind goes, your mind is just racing all over the place. There's the panic, there's the intensity of the pain, which is the physical sort of sensation. Then on top of that, there's the all the stuff around, have I ruined the wedding? How's Lucy doing? What am I going to do? Will I be able to walk down the aisle? All this is happening. My training sort of kicked in, and I was able to really sort of rest on the, like, place my attention to sensations, however difficult they were, because it meant that I avoided getting caught up in all the worry and the, once we'd managed to, there was a whole comedy of errors of how all the different, it ended up being like 11 or 13 different emergency service vehicles. So it was quite a scene. And so there's a whole finally I was able to find, because I was in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the Dorset countryside, so I had to shout out. And there just happened to be a fairly elderly old lady on the other side of the road who heard me shouting. And once she got over her initial freak out, she was able to initiate the 999 call and whatever. But just being able to stay calm and composed within that. And it was really tested my abilities, actually.
What was it you did in that moment then? You separated the worry and the thoughts moving at hyperdrive from the sensation itself. What was going on there?
Yeah. So what in practice happened was that I just really got into I just let my mind sort of really settled into the sensation. So I was just being with, like, just being as fully aware of, and the sensations were really difficult, but I wasn't laying anything on top of that. I wasn't laying any story or pushing away of the sensations. Because what I found, and both from my own personal practice and through sharing mindful stuff, is that often there's, when we're experiencing difficult experience, be that physical pain or emotional pain, whatever it might be, there's the initial difficulty, and then there's our relationship to that difficulty. So, for example, if I'm in for pain, there's a story in the book about a lady who has chronic pain, and she talks about how the freedom of actually relaxing the struggle with that pain. And so instead of just going, why am I in pain? Why me? Which is like a second order experience compared to the direct sensation of the pain, and being able to separate out in old school meditation world, you sometimes talk about the pain and then the suffering, and the suffering's optional in the sense that by adding more and more layers of resistance and struggle with what's actually happening.
One of the phrases that you use in the book to describe meditation or mindfulness in a nutshell is you talk about it as being holding life more lightly.
Yeah.
Is that what you were doing in that moment, in a sense?
Yeah, mechanics of the emergency services are working, and then in that moment you just have to be with that as much as you can, and allow yourself to just relax, even in a high pressure situation. And it was at the edge. I think if it had gone on for another 15 minutes, I might have got into the more sort of frantic side of me coming through. But thankfully, spoilers for the book, but thankfully I managed to even walk away, not particularly well, but I was totally fine the next day. And I was just a very, very lucky human being, really, because it could have been so much worse.
And maybe in some ways the best part was that your best man was not on site to take photographs of you to shame you with him for the rest of your life. It's interesting. It sounds like
avoiding tension. That's why I really, admittedly, this is like more of a visual metaphor than suitable for a podcast. But when you hold something very tightly, there's actually a lot of tension there. Even if something you're really trying to, even something you really love, just the act of, so if you're listening to the podcast, or you can sort of, if you ball your hand into a fist, like that's just a tense situation. But that moment when you just release your hand, and because you can still hold what's in your hand, but you don't have to really hold it really tightly to still experience it. And so that's a really important part of mindfulness meditation practice, because I think some people can, maybe who don't know it so well, can criticize it for being trying to deny certain aspects of life or trying to run away from certain things. But actually for me, It's always been about engaging with whatever's around as closely as possible.
Good or bad.
Good or bad.
Mm-hmm. We're using interchangeably the words meditation and mindfulness here. I wonder if you could just, you do it in the book, but just maybe briefly unpack those two terms.
Sure. So meditation and mindfulness, I do use them interchangeably, mainly because I think I talk about sort of two different definitions of mindfulness. One is a very specific definition, sort of a technical definition. So being aware of what's happening whilst it's happening. So being aware of what's happening in the body and in the mind. So right now for me, I can notice physical sensations of sitting here, a sense of calm, a little bit of tension in my back, some excitement, a little bit of embarrassment now that I'm talking. So like all these, that is a real time account mm-hmm. of my experience. And that's me being aware and expressing mindfulness of my experience. So that's a very specific technical definition. And it's the one you tend to hear a lot of, sort of being aware in the present. Other people talk about like being aware in the present moment and so on. And then the more general definition is the idea of, because meditation and mindfulness historically has been used interchangeably. And because there became a point in, I guess maybe a few years ago, when the word meditation had a little bit too much spiritual baggage, hippie baggage associated with it. And so people use this much more sort of newer word, mindfulness. Mm. So if you're trying to pitch a meditation program to a company or trying to raise X million dollars for a funding grant, it was easier to say mindfulness than it was to say meditation. Very practically, right? Yeah. So, and that's, and then in that case, the sort of general idea of mindfulness is effectively like, using your awareness in particular ways to achieve positive outcomes. So, for example, I'll just unpack that a bit more. So, there's sort of three elements to that. One is it's all about your awareness and your attention. So, this idea of paying attention to what's happening right now. The second part of the definition is around technique. So, you're doing it in particular ways. So, you're explicitly doing a technique on purpose. So when people say, when they hear that I do mindfulness meditation stuff, people say, oh, I'm listening to music is my mindfulness or my meditation or cycling is my meditation, all these different things. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't necessarily classify that in the same way because you're not actively doing a attention-based technique. And so whilst that is still those activities are still relaxing and important, I wouldn't necessarily call them mindfulness because I have more of a specific definition around that. And importantly, like meditation, mindfulness is importantly in service of a result. So I don't practice meditation to be mindful. That doesn't really mean anything. I practice it personally so that I can be calmer, kinder, more self-aware, mm-hmm. More wise even. So
it's a long list, that, isn't it? I mean, anytime you flick through BuzzFeed or look at a newspaper, there's a piece about the rise and the boom of mindfulness and meditation and so on, and endless lists of the benefits from health to creativity to wisdom and all these things you've just been outlining. But although the argument seems pretty compelling that meditation mindfulness is rather wonderful for the human animal, people still find it very hard to do. And you identify what the three problems. You talk about the time problem, the hippie problem, and the digital problem. Do you want to pick
sure. that so I think this is the like. There's, like you say, there's been so much interest and hype and buzz around mindfulness. But despite that, I found through sort of anecdotally and through research through the sort of company that I run, that the majority of people who actually are actively interested don't do anything about it. It's these three same reasons which come up all the time. One is I don't have time. I have a very busy lifestyle, and so I just can't make space for even 10, 20 minutes a day, let alone a course that takes 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. The second thing that comes up is it's too hippie. So the historical history of mindfulness and how it came through a spiritual route and spiritual package to us is still, people still consider those two, that they're one and the same thing, that all mindfulness is in some way religious or spiritual. And the third barrier to people getting into it is that they hear the message that to be mindful around technology is to throw it all away and to turn it all off. Whereas actually the majority of people, a lot of people have very active digital lives, and not only are they not inclined to throw it all away, they can't afford to, because it's part of their work life, it's part of their lifestyle. As someone who grew up meditating in a urban, digital, busy, in a lifestyle that sort of exactly...
In a fast world.
I started meditating pretty much at the same time I started working in London for like a classic big consulting company. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my work and a lot of my own practice is as a result of the marriage and creative tension between those two things. And the book effectively tries to solve, well, I think solves those three problems by presenting mindfulness in a way that is accessible and includes technology, presents in a way that you don't have to necessarily find additional time for it. You can do it alongside the things that you're already doing. And it presents mindfulness in a way. I think that you don't need to, if you don't have an interest in the spiritual aspects of it, you can just leave that alone. Mm-hmm. That now, one of the big developments in the last sort of 10, 15 years we've seen is all these different, to use a sort of designy word, like all these different use cases for mindfulness, all these different reasons and motivations why people get into it. And originally there was only one reason. It was a spiritual motivation. But then we added the clinical, the health, we started applying mindfulness techniques for chronic pain and all these different conditions. And suddenly we have a clinical medical use case. And now we have a corporate one. We have companies looking to sort of teaching mindfulness to their employees for productivity and for stress reduction.
And actually companies in the fastest moving sectors of the global economy, right? From Silicon Valley to Wall Street and the city.
You can't move in the Mission out in Menlo Park for people meditating the people sort of exactly. Facebook, Google famously have their own, they spun out their own program called Search Inside Yourself, which is a mindfulness based program. Twitter, I've been in contact with some of the senior team at Twitter, and they're actively pursuing all this stuff as well.
Well, as you say, this is something that you're finding right across the spectrum nowadays in different forms. And every week, I don't know how many mindfulness books or meditation books are coming out. There are many of them. But yours feels like to me that standing away or moving forward, moving the conversation forward and saying that meditation doesn't have to be what a lot of people assume it is, which is sitting alone in a room for 10 hours on end with a shaven head. Chanting Om, that it can be, is westernized the right word, or modernized, or made to fit into a modern life? I guess that's what you're seeking to do here.
Yeah, I would say personalized and made more accessible. Mm-hmm. Because when the opportunity came to write a mindfulness book, like you say, there's so many titles out there, right? But I found when I was thinking about, do I really want to write a mindfulness book? Do I want to write just another mindfulness book? That was something that was... given that I found looking at all the titles, I found that a lot of them were saying the same thing, just slightly veneered with a different angle, whereas essentially presenting the same material for different audiences. And I, in partly, wrote the book as a response to my sense that the mindfulness bookshelf in the stores and online were a little bit conservative. Talking to the same people. Mm-hmm. And so what about the people who aren't into the type of mindfulness that is being presented? I think the mindfulness world in general, I have several critiques of the mindfulness world. One of them is it's become very narrow around the way that it teaches meditation. So it basically says this is my sort of heartbreaking paradox at the heart of mindfulness at the moment. We have all this good news on one hand saying, hey, mindfulness is great, here's all this data and research of how useful it is, and on the other hand, but to get all those benefits you've got to find time, and that's the scarce resource. Mm-hmm. Right. But my own experience was that it was possible to practice with intensity, with integrity, with authenticity, alongside the activities you're already doing. So that's this idea of mobile mindfulness, which is sort of presented in the book, which is instead of trying to get people to change their lifestyles to make mindfulness work for them, why don't we bring mindfulness to where people already are? And so give them techniques which they can apply at times of the day alongside their existing activities. So when they're at work, when they're traveling, when they're walking around, when they're at the gym, when they're browsing through Instagram. And then if they want to then deepen that by doing some formal sitting practice, then absolutely.
Which you're not against,
I absolutely advocate that. But I think if we put all the pressure on formal sitting practice, then we risk people, it's hard to go there straight away.
Yeah. So are you in a sense using what you're calling informal practice or mobile meditation and mindfulness as a gateway drug, or as a kind of springboard to getting people to do the, or you see the two as being two sides of the same coin?
Well, I'd say firstly, if all you want to do is a mobile style practice where, you learn a technique that is really useful when you're preparing to give a talk at work, or when you're trying to stay concentrated, or when you're walking around town. And if that's all you do, then I think that's totally fine. Mm-hmm. I think there's another one of my critiques is that the meditation world is trying to turn everyone into meditators rather than solve their problems. And I think if we basically saying, and this is why I don't use the word informal meditation, because there's a value judgment inherent in that, where you say, if you were to call one formal and one informal, implicit in that is, the sitting meditation is the really good stuff, and everything else is just, it's all very well, Carl, but really, you should really be sitting for half an hour a day. For example, I sort of give this example a lot, which is sort of, there's an interesting phenomenon recently of elite athletes using mindfulness, be that, so Seattle Seahawks, who won the Super Bowl a couple of years ago, have a really mature mindfulness program, and they use it, and they basically, and a number of golfers and so on use it, because they sort of perform and stay present in what I really hope thinking this part is the difference between being a major champion and not, then you use everything you can to have the edge to be really calm and grounded in that moment. And so if an elite golfer wants to use mindfulness to be present and they only use it for that and they don't do any formal sitting, then why are we judging them again? What's wrong with that? There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. They're using intentional skill in a moment when they need it. I think a lot of the mindfulness world says, well, that's all very well, but it's not the real thing.
That's mindfulness light.
Yeah, but I think mindfulness light comes from a very agendered position. So people talk about muck mindfulness as well. Mm-hmm. It's sort of another phrase. But I think if you want to get the most out of mindfulness, I think it's a case of balancing both things. Practicing in all situations, in all activities, as well as doing formal practice to deepen. Because if you look at the other side, people who exclusively do formal practice, you often find, I've someone who's spent a lot of time, be it on retreat and with some of my best friends are meditators, probably most of my friends, but most of my best friends, but the danger of overemphasizing formal practice is that people then struggle to make it real in the midst of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I've met people who are brilliant technical meditators on the cushion, so to speak, which is the phrase, but then they've got useless social skills. They don't know how to pay attention to their partner because they're not training in those situations.
It's in a vacuum.
But those are the moments when you need them. It's an absolute no-brainer that at least part of our practice should be trained in the situations, because if you're training in an isolated room in under lab conditions and by yourself, and like the Yes, there will be that. Like, there's a, like, some of those benefits will leak into your wider life, but that isn't necessarily the case. Mm. So, you know, like running on a treadmill is different to running on the road. There's some differences. Like, you can run on a treadmill, and if you could actually close your eyes and get going, and like you could actually do that if you really wanted to, but you couldn't do that when you do it on the road, right? Mm. And likewise, like, when you're at work, there are different types of skills that you need when you're in relation, like in relationship, be that sort of professional or personal. When you're dealing with all the different sort of all the technologies around us, so why not train those? Learn how to be kind and self-aware and wise in those situations as well. Mm-hmm. And so I'd say the sort of shorthand would be. As certainly the approach that I present in the book is sort of, why don't we just go with 80% mobile practice backed up by 20% formal practice.
On the cushions.
Yeah, and like, yeah, so it's sort of, because they both those styles really work together.
Is that you? Is that the split
That's
you have in your life?
My own experience of my own practice.
One thing I loved about the book was this idea of designing your own form of meditation and your own mix and getting your own formula and pieces of the puzzle together. Maybe this is a good moment to walk us through just some of the, because the book is stuffed with little techniques and examples and hacks, I suppose maybe is the right word for some of these ways of bringing mindfulness into everyday life in a fast world. I've wrote down a list of some of the ones that jumped out for me, but I don't want to put you on the spot, you know, but you know, there was the cyborg sense, street feet, advert jujitsu, mouse sweeper, inbox addict. Can you even remember what all these are now? Or maybe there's others that you'd rather share. Maybe just walk us through just briefly, maybe two or three of them.
So like you said, like the book has like 60 or different mini techniques that are sort of out and about. And a lot of them are actually ones that I've, the vast majority are ones that I've just done myself. So for example, advert jujitsu is one that you... So as a new meditator, spending a lot of time on the tube when I was still living in London, I noticed how, obviously, my meditation is all about your attention. I noticed how effective adverts were in drawing my attention. That's basically their job, right? Mm. Here I was sort of sitting on the tube trying to keep my attention contained in one place, and then everything around me was sort of trying to grab it. And I thought, well, why don't we actually use that? This is where the sort of jujitsu idea came in, which is how to actually use the power of that to actually in my favor. And the practice is really simple. So distraction is such a, or the other way around, like the ability to remain non-distracted is a really powerful skill in just generally in life, and especially now in a sort of attention economy and information world. Something that I really highly value. And so the practice is whenever you notice your mind being pulled away.
By an advert.
You literally just notice that and go, oh, I'm distracted. And as soon as you know that you're distracted, you, by definition, you're not distracted anymore because you're being aware of that process. And then you become more, as you become interested in that sort of process of things calling your mind away, then you it becomes even more subtle over time where you notice which adverts draw your attention more. Maybe it's a certain type of photograph or a certain type of message. And you learn more about what is it that pulls my attention away? Because when we know and when we understand what pulls our attention away, we're able to... we've got more control to keep it in one place because we can put in some measures and go, oh, actually, no, yeah. So that...
Did you deploy that technique on the way here this morning?
Absolutely. And what I love about attention jiu-jitsu is that it totally ruins the advertising.
Yeah, sorry.
Because you're using advertising to do the opposite of what it's intended to do. And it's a playful idea. It's like this whole idea of... I was very, very inspired in this by the idea of, like... this idea of sort of using everything around us as our playground, rather than thinking of the meditation cushion as the only space where we're allowed to explore this stuff. Why can't everything be a playground for developing ourselves?
And even the most simple things we do in that playground, right? You have the street feet idea of world.
Yeah, absolutely. So street feet is one of the most simple and lovely things, which is quite simply when walking around to... just let your attention be in the physicality of the movement. because we spend so much time when we're walking from A to B, just thinking about, I need to, so if you're going to your next meeting or whatever, just being caught up in that meeting, just thinking about it, or you're obviously like doing the classic thing of just ruminating or daydreaming, which is all fine as well. Like, so I'm not a daydreaming Nazi, but that's a thing. The lovely thing about Street Feet is it's just a way of having a break. It's a really refreshing way to rest your attention in the body and just appreciate and enjoy the walking. We get so many. It's a really nice. I like it. It's like a little stealth break, little stealth holiday. Mm-hmm. You know, like we spend so much time moving from place to place, and we're so busy all the time. Why not just use these little moments to rest? And it's a dynamic form of rest. It's one of the things that I really like about it, is that there's a bit of stillness despite the fact we're moving.
What about the technology component in all of this? Because I think some people find this the hardest to get their head around.
Yeah.
Because and you touch on this in the book, how a lot of people feel overwhelmed by technology. We all have that sense, and that technology in a sense gets vilified, doesn't it? And we use pejorative words like detox and so on. And it's a word I don't use either, because I do love the technology and I don't think it's toxic. It really comes down to how we use it. But I feel like you're going maybe a little further than I am, because I'm definitely advocate switching off. I got the feeling a little bit more than maybe you do. That you feel that technology can be harnessed to help us be mindful. And of course, with your own mindfulness app, Buddhify, you've shown how that can work. Before we sort of dig into the idea of technology and so on, maybe talk us through a couple of the cyborg sense, mouse sweeper, and inbox addict, all these glorious
So cyborg titles. Sense is based on the very simple idea that, the first thing, when you go to a meditation class, the first thing you'll learn is something like paying attention to your breath. So being aware of your body. So with similar to Street Feet, paying attention to the body is like mindfulness 101. And I don't know about you, but my phone is pretty much a part of my body now. I'm so often in the position of holding it that it's as much a part of me as anything else. And so this idea of a cyborg, that's where the name came from. So then I sort of played around with that idea. If the phone was a part of my body, then why don't I include that in my body awareness? So these are alarmingly simple practices, but when you do them and you combine them and do them over the time, then they can have a real powerful effect. And so, for example, this is quite simply, when you're using your phone, often we just get sucked into the content of the screen, and there's very little body awareness. And so why not actually use the physicality of the phone and being aware of, be it the texture of the back of the phone as you're holding it, the feeling of the sort of little ridges over the buttons, the smoothness of the screen. And when you do that, when you allow that sense of physical awareness into your experience of using the phone, every app has the opportunity to become a mindfulness app. You don't have to use a Buddhify or a Headspace or a Calm.
Because you're bringing mindful. A mindful spirit.
Because you're holding your phone mode. In a mindful way.
Yeah.
So you can, or with an element of mindfulness. And so, and what's lovely about that is, because part of your attention is resting in the physical sensation, you're less likely to get drawn, sort of pulled away into content, and you can use it in a way that maybe has a bit more agency and control. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the cyborg sense. The inbox addict is one that I... Literally, so when writing the book, right, so I'd never written a book before, I bow down to a writer such as you, able to do it over long periods of time. And I was really struggling with distraction. I was really struggling with wanting to check my phone every 5 minutes. I made it a bit of a, similar to the advert idea, I made it a bit of a game of like, where in the process of distraction can I catch myself, was the challenge I gave myself, and the sort of the challenge in inbox addict. So sometimes you'll just be unaware and the next thing you know, you're strolling through Instagram.
Yeah.
Like you just wake up in this sort of like, in your Twitter feed or whatever, social media feed. Where for me, like email is sort of probably maybe a bit more addictive to me than social media. And so, and then I was like, okay, then I was able to, can I catch myself early? So next time when I was distracted, I was able to notice like my hand moving to my phone. And then you sort of become more aware and you notice these little, your impulse of your hand is like leaving your...
Almost like a physical tick, isn't
yeah,
it?
Like yeah, like leaving your keyboard and moving to your phone or going to that browser, moving the mouse. So you sort of catch it early in the process. And then what I found when you're really skilled and you do this for, and you really sort of get into this and find it fun and playful, you might even notice how you feel before that impulse even happens. And what I found was that when writing the book and I was getting distracted, it was mainly because I felt a little bit restless, or I felt sometimes a little bit sad, or I had a bit of self-doubt in what I was doing. And so in a way, my going to, and what I saw was that my going to distract myself was me being kind myself, kind because I wanted to sort of get rid of
escape,
this feeling.
Escape those feelings.
Yeah, maybe. And so when I had the level of self-awareness, I go, oh, actually, I'm just feeling a bit doubty or sad or lonely or restless. Then you're able to, when you see that, you're able to, oh, okay, just let that happen. And then you sort of catch the process so much earlier.
And short-circuit it.
Short-circuit it, exactly, through the power of just simple awareness. Mm-hmm. And that was what allowed me to, because I'd done all the environmental things around me, like I'd hired a separate office for my writing, so it'd be completely different to my normal work life, and had all this dedicated, I had a special computer that did it, had nothing else on it, sort of thing. But this distraction was still coming.
It was still you.
Yeah, and so because it's like we often blame the technology for our distraction, and certainly a lot of our technologies are designed to be distracting, so they're not innocent in this. But fundamentally, what I found is that it's the inability to deal with just to let difficult experiences happen that makes us want to distract ourselves. That's sort of the invitation of that practice is to people to find out for themselves. What is it like being interested in your distractions is the best way to develop concentration, because you can sort of brute force your way into concentration. So you can do lots of sort of concentration techniques. Mm-hmm. But what I find is that understanding the barriers to concentration is a much more powerful and sustainable way to.
And in a sense, what you've done there is you've slowed down the whole process long enough to see all the different stages.
Yeah.
And then you can see this stage happens here. I can come in and break it. I can deploy some jujitsu and move in a different direction.
Yeah.
Whereas if you just move very quickly without awareness,
yeah,
you can't.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think the
find a remedy.
And the way, like, I'm glad you brought up that sort of thing about designing your own meditation, because I think that for me is really important in that all the things that I offer in the book are sort of examples and invitations to people to actually find out their own, because no one knows your life like you. So like there's a danger in the meditation world of like us just telling you what to do and like going, this is what you should do. This is like your best map to your life. But actually for techniques and practices to really work, they should not only map directly to your own experience, but if you've actually come up with that technique yourself, then that's a really lovely thing and wonderful thing. And so the formula is not that complicated. The formula is understand at the heart of like all of mindfulness meditation, there's sort of basically half a dozen core techniques. And once you understand those core techniques and then go, oh, how do I apply concentration practice to this situation? How do I apply self-awareness to this? How do I apply kindness practice to this situation? And then that, and then when you sort of take a core technique and then explore and play around with the context where you are, whether that's at the gym or at your writing desk, then that gives you the opportunity to actually design your own practice. And hopefully the book sort of gives you ideas for you then go and customize your own. I think because what I'm sort of not spoken so much about the app stuff, but I think one of the unintended consequences of Buddhify and other mindfulness apps, which is something that sort of worries me, is that we've made people who are dependent on apps to meditate. Well, this is quite a new phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So historically, you'd like learn a technique and then go and do it by yourself. Whereas now people, what I found, just like looking at the data from Buddhify and also speaking to our users, that many of them get a lot of value out of it, which is great, but they also are dependent on the track or the guidance and feel they can't do it by themselves. And for me, that's a real That's something I want to change.
Is that one of the reasons you wrote the book?
Yeah, absolutely. To empower people to become independent meditators. Mm. So fundamentally, like, it's good that whether they use if they're using an app and they are dependent on them, that's fun. I'd rather they do that than not do that, and that they have a technique that is useful for them. But my concern is that we're creating a generation of meditators or mindfulness practitioners who can only do it using these tools.
You're quite optimistic about the technology, aren't you? Because you've already touched on the fact that so much of it is designed to chip away at our attention and to distract us for commercial reasons, you know, take us off to look at bits of clickbait and advertisements and so on. But you, towards the end of the book, you really come out fairly optimistically on it, don't you? Feeling that we're coming to maybe a crossroads where more and more apps will be mindful. If you go to Silicon Valley, I mean, as you said before, everybody's meditating. So the people who are building these things are maybe baking it into their, not only their own personal lives, but their work lives as well. How do you see that evolving over the next, is this something that's going to come very quickly now, or is it always going to be a slight minority track, the mindfulness approach to technology? Are we always going to be pestered and bombarded by deliberately distracting gadgets and technology?
I am optimistic, and the reason I'm optimistic is that we're still in the early days of mindfulness. Whilst it has a lot of attention hype, we're still quite in the early days of it as a, I guess, cultural phenomenon, a cultural practice. And there's currently all these technology companies that are doing mindfulness training. At the moment, it's being perceived purely as a well-being program. Whereas the big opportunity is people to, like, there's at the moment very little transfer between what people are learning for their own well-being and the actual products that they're making. Mm-hmm. But I think there becomes a point where when you become more literate about how your awareness is being kicked around, and how the impact of our technologies on our mental well-being, as it becomes more of a global conversation and an individual personal inquiry, I believe that people can only start to ask some serious questions that actually, is this good for us? Like, can I actually include well-being as a design condition in how I'm designing software?
Of all kinds, not just the well-being sector.
We're obviously seeing a little boom in products which are explicitly badged mindfulness, explicitly badged well-being, and that's great. But that's always ever going to be small fry, to be honest. Mm-hmm. The real opportunity, the thing that will really generate social change, is when these principles become baked into everything, into every product.
And you believe that can happen?
I think it can happen, because at the moment we're at a point where, so big tech companies, even small tech companies, have banks of people, psychologists, behavioral economists, neuroscientists, all basically working to get you hooked into their product. Again, we can those that skill set can also be you.
That's flipped on its head, couldn't it?
It's basically Anakin Skywalker, right? Like, it's Luke versus Darth Vader. We're in a bit on the dark side at the moment, but you have to believe in the force for good, right? And you have to believe that there's going to be a point, because I do genuinely believe that if you look at what's happened to ad blockers in the last 18 months as a whole thing, where people have sort of said enough's enough to advertising, and it's become a much bigger uptake in that, and people are sort of valuing their attention more. And once those types of things happen, markets have to respond to that. They have to evolve around that.
If the optimistic vision comes to be and we move away from the dark side to the light side, what does the light side look like? Is it a world where we are connected all the time to our gadgets, but we're connected mindfully? Or are we still going to have to switch off sometimes completely and exist without any kind of link to the grid?
I think there's always benefit to that. I think there's always benefit to switching off, taking time away.
Let me just break in, because this might be a good time to cycle back to something you said earlier in the conversation. You talked about, let's think of it as the S word, spiritualism. Mm. In the book, you approach the subject almost apologetically a little bit. You sort of say, well, you know, it's got to be in here. I know that you, and you said at the beginning of the interview as well that people could, but let me just come to you.
Yeah, yeah.
It rang a lot of bells with me because in my work, I feel getting people to slow down. The image I always have in my head is that of a Trojan horse, which is that you arrive and on the outside, you're offering people, you say you slow down, you're going to be more productive, you're going to be happier, you're going to be healthier, more connected, you're going to live more deeply and so on. But actually, when people do all of those things, to me, that's always the first stage and there's something deeper goes on. And whether you call it spiritual, whether you call it just simply confronting the big questions in life and the world around us, facing your inner demons, finding your better angels, whatever the right wording is, I feel like that's for me the end game. Is that really, I got the impression that was the end game for you too, and that you were sort of still slightly dancing around that kind of feeling that you didn't want to scare people off with
the
spiritual thing, or is that unfair?
No, I'd say I wouldn't say I was skirting around this, but I think what a lot of pop mindfulness books actually do is ignore the spiritual aspect for fear that people will perceive it as being just all the emotional baggage that people have around spirituality and so on. So I included it because I think it's a critical part of understanding mindfulness. The practices, the overall sort of constellation of practices that live within this thing we call mindfulness were designed as a spiritual tool. They weren't designed to be more present. Like to be in the moment. That's basically like just the start. The mindfulness tradition was fundamentally designed to really look closely at the nature of identity and look at some quite sort of hardcore aspects of what it is to be a human and what is the self, really. And over time, we've had all these different sort of different uses of mindfulness, and so have evolved out of that. So I think I wouldn't say it's the end game in that you don't have to go there, but to not include it would have been negligent and not respecting the tradition.
I guess what I'm asking you is, are you hoping that people will end up there?
I think there's a natural, there's like a percentage of people who...
will take it only so far and then stop.
Yeah, so it's a bit like some people who take up running will become triathletes. Some people will just do a bit of running now and then. And neither is better than the other. Some are just a little bit more hardcore. I think the more and more you get into mindfulness, I think there's definitely a gravity there, which leads you into more spiritual territory, which if you're willing to go there, then there's a lot of things that can open up. But it's absolutely not necessary. I think it's a personal proclivity, I think. And because when you get into meditation mindfulness, you tend to come in for a particular reason, like, oh, I'm stressed or I've got some pain issue or whatever it is. And if the practice helps you solve that problem and you decide to go, that's it. That's why I'm happy to just hang out with this understanding. Then I think that's totally fine. But there's definitely rabbit holes that you can wander down and threads you can pull on. And that's the joy of discovery. And I think that's why presenting mindfulness in as broad a way as possible just opens the door to more people to just, whether it's just solving their initial problem or they go all the way into the hardcore stuff. At least I'll have a chance to do that. But I don't think that people have to.
A final thought before we wrap up. You make a point in the book of underlining how mindfulness is not just a personal and individual thing, a lonely thing. And often I think mindfulness and meditation is presented that way. The imagery of it is someone sitting on the cushion alone. But you talk about the communal aspect of it, which I found really interesting. Do you want to just...
Absolutely. I can't stand we have these stock images.
If you do the Google search on images.
Just like the woman in the rainforest by themselves in splendid isolation. It just doesn't reflect. And I think that's one of the reasons people find it inaccessible. That's not my life. And also most people, the benefits of mindfulness are very much with other people. Just being able to improve your relationship and ability to deal with all the joys and struggles of not just yourself, but other humans as well. And I think historically, this is another actual issue. Historically, mindfulness has always been something that's been social. It's been a community practice. It always like a teacher-student relationship and all these different ways in which people have explored this stuff together and supported each other through learning more about their minds and so on. And this is a this is another sort of unintended consequence of mindfulness apps, is that when you're plugging in your headphones and listening to MP3s, which again, we're creating a generation of solo practitioners who don't include other people in their practice. And I think that's a real, something that I'm concerned about, to be honest.
And so you make a real point in the book, don't you, of getting people, encouraging them to meditate together, to share their experience in meditation.
Absolutely.
So that's a big part of what
Absolutely. And I think I'm particularly interested at the moment in techniques where you have to have another person in. So social techniques. And because it means that it becomes more fun. Like there's ways of, I'm very influenced by games and gaming and how, and playfulness in general, and how the risk of sort of isolating yourself further through solo practice, just when there's an opportunity, just include as many people as possible. So in the same way that you use your phone or the adverts around you on the tube as part of your practice, then including all the people around you as well. And it can become just, it's a really simple way of bringing more sort of joy and connection. I think especially in a, there's a lot of arguments at the moment around whether technology disconnects us or connects us. But while we still have the luxury of there being lots of people around us, let's actually include them in our understanding of things.
Because we don't want meditation to become a tool for turning us into lonely but very efficient corporate warriors.
Absolutely, and I think that's definitely I think there's lots of how you practice meditation is sort of dictates the results you have. And so if you do a lot of solo practice, then you risk not being able to express those qualities with other people. But if you actively include other people, then it just means that it's a more vibrant and fun experience. And I think that's for me like something that, as someone who works in mindfulness apps and technologies, is that we've not really explored this social aspect at all. And it's like, that's one of the products we're working on right now, actually, sort of how do we include the other in a fun way.
And that's where the interview ends. Not because it was a smooth and elegant sign-off, but because my podcasting equipment failed. If you hadn't already noticed, I'm still learning the ropes here, and sometimes, or maybe more often than sometimes, the technology gets the better of me. I am working on it, promise. So apologies for the abrupt end to my chat with Rohan. We were winding down anyway. The only thing you missed were the thank yous and the goodbyes. And, of course, Rohan's website address, Mindfulness Everywhere, with no punctuation, mindfulnesseverywhere.io. So thank you for listening to this episode of the Slow Revolution podcast. Hope you enjoyed it, and catch you next time. Bye-bye.